And this gentleman used to live here in Middle Tennessee.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he wrote this book called The Shack.
Okay.
And it became a sensation. I mean, I think they've sold like 1 trillion. I think they've surpassed McDonald's now.
Oh, wow.
They stopped counting. It's
if
sold
you
so
lay
many.
The amount of books end to end, how
long is it? But it was one of those books that gripped people's attention, and it caused no small amount of controversy. And it's a phenomenal book, and Paul Young is with us. So, Paul, we're going to get right to it. Paul, are you with us?
I am certainly with you.
Paul,
and just think about this. We've got Peter, John,
and Paul.
I know, right?
At one time.
My confirmation name is George. Does that help?
Okay. My first name is William.
As long as Ringo's not anywhere around. So,
not really.
Listen, first off, thank you for taking the time to call and share this. I got to ask you, Paul, because from what I understand, and I'm just going to jump right into this, this book started really from humble and from what I gather, rather painful events that prompted you to go into this this story and craft this story.
Yeah. So people ask me how long it took to write it, and I tell them 50 years, because you have to live a while, I think, before you write stuff that actually resonates with human beings the way The Shack has. And it does. It comes out of great sadness and all of those terms. You know, I am Mackenzie. In fact, a writer from Nashville, Leanne Stewart, wrote me when the book first came out, and she said, you know, I don't know anything about you or who you are, but my sense is that Missy, who is the main character's daughter, who is abducted and feared to have been really brutally murdered, and that's the centerpiece of the storyline, although it's never graphic, and the movie's not graphic either, so you don't have to worry about that. But she said, my sense is that Missy represents something murdered in you as a child, probably your innocence. And Mackenzie is you as the adult trying to deal with that. But she was absolutely spot on. That means that she had read it in a way that, you know, she got past just the storyline and into some of the depths of it. And so I am Mackenzie, and I am Melissa Ann Missy, Melissa Ann Phillips. And both of them, their names spell map on purpose so that you've got that interplay between the two characters. And So it is a story, and it has power as a story, because I think good stories always are powerful. I think every human being is a story, and yet on another whole level, it wraps up my history. And I wrote it as just a gift for my kids, because Kim had been asking me for about 4 years, you know, someday, as a gift for our kids, would you just write something that puts in one place how you think, because you think outside the box. And later, by the way, when the book was in print, she said, you know, when I asked you, I was thinking like 4 to 6 pages. And I wrote most of it on the train to one of my 3 jobs. My great sadness is growing up. I'm a missionary kid, preacher's kid, and grew up in the highlands of New Guinea. And I had a very difficult relationship with my dad. And as a result, I think, largely, I had a difficult relationship with God as Father, and that took me a lot of years. It took me 50 years to wipe the face of my own father off the face of God. Then a second great sadness had to do with sexual abuse, which happened in the tribal culture, and then when I was sent away to missionary boarding school when I was 6. And after that, there was just sexual abuse inside. You know, the big boys would come at night and molest the little boys, So, you know, and there's nothing quite like sexual abuse. It just rips the fabric of the human soul apart. And I know you have a lot of heroic people that listen to your show. I mean, people who care for those who cannot care for themselves, or who assist those who don't have the capacity. Those people are the hands and feet of Jesus, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, you go through trauma, and you go through darkness, and you go through great sadness. And the questions are legitimate. So I wrote a book for my kids saying, basically, I don't want you growing up with the God that I grew up with, because that God was no help. That's the distant, unapproachable, unreachable, omni-being watching from the infinite distance of a disapproving heart. It is the God who requires sacrifice and performance and all this, and the God that Jesus came to save us from. And I'm going like, you know what? I don't want you growing up with that God. Let me see if I can craft imagery that is helpful, that that gives us a sense of the relationship of a God who is a God of relentless affection, who climbs into our great sadnesses and our difficulties on a daily basis and crafts with us inside the grace of just one day at a time something that is alive, something that matters. And I write this little book. I make 15 copies at Office Depot, and those 15 copies did everything I ever wanted this book to do. And yet now it's done this absolutely unparalleled kind of thing for a book that was printed at Office Depot. It's in what, 50 languages and 22 plus million copies that have sold. And so it's just the sense of the grace of God behind this. And the other thing too is that it gave people two things: a language to have a conversation about God that wasn't religious, and a validation for our great sadnesses. It says, you know what? The struggle you're in, the tears that you cry, those tears actually matter. And your story matters. You know, you're the one that Jesus left the 99 to go find. And I'm the one. And it just has resonated with people. And even though some of my own people, you know, fundamental evangelical, modern evangelical religious folk, have some difficulty with what I did, they're my people, and I know how what they're afraid of and what they're stuck about. But for so many millions of people, the book has been a pathway into an honest conversation about tragedy and loss and hope and redemption and forgiveness and the things that truly matter to us as human beings.
You said a couple of things there that resonated: relentless affection of God, and that you also, it was a way to validate the great sadness that we have in our own pain. And when I read this book, you know, I've been watching my wife being wheeled down surgery corridors now for so many years. I mean, and it just kept going and going and going, and the relentless pain. And that's when your book came into my life and said, where is God in these long hospital corridors? You know, that's where it came with me. And when I read this book and I realized, you know, he is here, and he's not abandoning me. And this is not some kind of curse. This is not some kind of deformity that is somehow
or failure of faith.
And it was such a breath of fresh air to be able to have that conversation and talk about how that's impacted. You know, and I will tell you this. My mother wanted me to tell you this. She took your book. Mom and Dad have had a ministry to death row inmates for years. I mean, like almost 20 years. And they've taken your book down to these death row inmates who could wrap their minds around what you were saying. You gave them language to process, because you talk about having to wipe their father's face off the face of God. And that's what they did this. And they took this down there. And there's I don't know how many inmates on death row that Mom and Dad have engaged with. And your book has been a part of that. How does that resonate with you as an author when you hear stuff like that? Because those are powerful stories, and I know you have millions of stories like that. And just share some of that.
Well, 3 months ago, I was on death row in Tennessee with Terry King. Spent about 2.5 hours with him and Ron, Terry's been on death row for 33 years, and Ron's been on death row for 30 years. And it was through a friend of a friend that I got invited to spend 2.5 hours with these gentlemen. And let me tell you, these are two guys who the Shack has absolutely wrecked their world in the best possible way. And let me tell you how this worked for Terry. So I'm there for 2.5 hours with these guys. And Terry would reach over and he'd just touch my arm and he'd start to cry. And he would say, I can't believe you're actually here. And he said, you know, when I read your book, I got to the chapter, it's chapter 11, where Mackenzie has to face the wisdom of God. And it's a very confrontive chapter about how judgmental we are, where we judge everything and we also judge God. We judge that God is not good. And we've done that. We have come up with a theology that has placed all this brokenness at the feet of God. And sadly, Christians are we say some of the stupidest things sometimes to people who are in pain, like, oh, this was God's will, or this was the plan of God, or, you know, and I go on and on about the stupid things that we Christians say. But again, he says, so I'm in this confrontation. He said, I never really dealt with what I had done, you know, and he was on death row for a reason. And it's like, I never really had done dealt with it because at least I wasn't a pedophile. He said, I had spent these years judging those guys, and because I judged them, I didn't deal with what I had done. And he said, it was so powerful in my cell that I was literally on the floor of the cell, crawling on it as if I was trying to get out of my own skin.
Oh man!
And he said, that's when I began to realize what I had done. And that's when I owned it, and that's what opened up a doorway to freedom. There's one example, and I'm so grateful for what your mom and dad do. And this is what Terry said. He said, you know, so since then, he said, I've been trying to find somebody who'll come and visit the pedophiles on death row because some of them haven't had a visitor in, you know, decades, and not one. And so what your parents are doing and what your caregivers are doing who listen to your show, come on, these folks are the heroes, man. I wrote a book, and let me tell you, one of my grandkids will outlast every creative thing I've ever done other than being a participant in bringing new life into this world. And so,
can you repeat that again for the people in the back?
I love that line. Go ahead and say that one more time, Paul, that you're one of your grandkids. I love that.
Oh, one of my grandchildren will outlive all the, you know, what the world counts as a creative success, you know, the book or the movie and all that kind of stuff. One, and here is a good picture, because every child that comes into this universe is because two human beings have made a choice, that there has been, whether those choices were defensible or not defensible, whether the motives were wrong or right, God still submitted to their choice to create a human being, and he climbs into that and sparks the life that will be eternal. I mean, every one of our children is an eternal being. So that tells you that the way God sees the universe is different than us. I mean, we'll applaud the book and the movie and the song and whatever, but one child, all of that. There's a scene that's so great, and they captured it really well in the movie, and it's from the book, and Mackenzie and Jesus are talking on the dock, and Jesus, they're looking at this incredible expanse of night stars, because this is the creative work of Jesus. And Jesus says, you know, Mackenzie, all of this, all as beautiful as it is, doesn't begin to compare with how we see you.
Wow.
And that's the truth. So your caregivers, who every day are putting one foot in front of the other, are living inside the grace of the day, because, you know, when you deal with death row or you deal with an illness that you're just fighting against it every day, whether it's Alzheimer's or something else, the truth of it is that what you're doing actually matters. Every moment of that is infused by the presence of God and the goodness of God, because you're an expression of it. That desire to care for that one you love did not originate in you. You share it, but it did not originate there. That is the love of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit being expressed through your participation inside the grace of a day, and what you're doing really matters.
Paul, that is incredibly beautiful to hear, and we got to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and wrap this up. Can you hang with us through the break?
Absolutely.
All right, we'll be right back. This is Paul Young, author of The Shack, and you're not going to want to miss this. He deals with the hard realities of life, of pain, of horrific things in the context of dealing with the Almighty and the Trinity. And you're not going to want to miss it. Paul Young, we'll be right back. This is Peter Rosenberger.
Here's some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for health insurance, or if you signed up for a plan you're not happy with, you still have a choice. MediShare is a healthcare sharing program. Hundreds of thousands of Christians are part of this. It can save you a lot. Typical savings for a family is about $500 a month. You can join MediShare anytime. It's easy to call and look into it. There's no pressure at all. And man, what a difference it can make. 855-25-SHARE. That's 855-25-SHARE.
Welcome back to the show for caregivers, about caregivers, hosted by a caregiver. I am Peter Rosenberger. The show is Hope for the Caregiver. We're continuing our interview with Paul Young, author of The Shack, the wildly best-selling book that hit and is also now a major motion picture. Paul, I want you to know how much I appreciate the words that you said about caregivers. There are so many who are laboring under this misguided thing that somehow they've been forgotten by God. They go, I've said this for a long time, that caregivers struggle with three I's. We lose our identity, we lose our independence, and we become isolated. And caregivers can feel isolated in a crowded room. We can feel isolated on a crowded pew. And that's something I'm on a mission to help churches understand, is the brokenhearted isolation that is sitting right there in front of them in the actual church, if they could get to that church. And then they're hearing about all this victory, and then they go home and deal with horrific circumstances. You have given a toolbox for people to understand that this is not a judgment from God. I remember when Gracie was going through all these things, and people would say awful things like you just referenced. Close up with just one more word of encouragement to these folks who are just feeling like God has abandoned them.
This is what I wish the church would understand, that any healthy family moves at the speed of the slowest. And if you think about it, you immediately, that makes sense to you. That if you got a child that comes into this world because of genetics and because of what human beings have done to the planet and for all kinds of other reasons, they come in broken. You know that family begins to slow down. Any healthy family moves at the speed of the slowest. And when church becomes an institution, it doesn't care about the slowest. And it's because it's an institution. Institutions don't have real life. And we've got to remember that the church has always been about people. So we need to change the way that we relate and understand that we've got to slow down the pace so that we can move also at the speed of the slowest. And the other thing, too, is that you're not designed for isolation. We're made in the image of a God who's never been alone. Aloneness doesn't exist within the Imago Dei, the image of God that we're made in, and we're not designed for it. We need community, and you cannot do this stuff by yourself. So, you know, the thing about it is that we've lied so long about the goodness of God that we don't believe it anymore. And that you can't run to God as a source of comfort if he is the source of our pain. It's just, you can't trust someone who's not good all the time. And part of all that I'm trying to say is, this is a God who's good all the time and involved in the details of our lives.
Hmm. Paul, that's what I need to hear as a caregiver. And I know that I speak for so many who are daily, relentlessly dealing with this. And I want you to know how grateful I am that you have taken the time and come and share your heart, things you've learned, not the easy way. No, I don't think any of us learn this kind of stuff the easy way. But no. You have shared, you have opened up your heart and shared, and really been a blessing today. You've helped me as a caregiver and me personally.
Yeah, I'm so honored. And the movie is powerful, and it is a beautiful adaptation of the book. Anybody that loved the book will not be disappointed by the movie.
Oh,
and take tissue. I mean, it'll sing to you.
Well, being from South Carolina, we'll take toilet paper, rolls of toilet paper. We're not.
Come on.
Well, listen, thank you so much for this, Paul. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for the honor and the privilege of participating. Blessings on your day. Bye-bye.
This is what this show is about, equipping you to stay strong and healthy in the midst of these horrific things. And I'm on a mission to do this. And we're going to bring you great shows, great programs, great conversations from folks who can help you. And I've got it all out there in a nice aggregated package at the website where you can take advantage of this and you can all of a sudden find that you're not alone in the thoughts that you've been having, the feelings that you've been having. If you're feeling it, we're discussing it. I mean, there is nothing that goes on in a caregiver's life that we don't address on this show. And I am grateful that you're taking 1 hour. This is your respite hour for you to dial in and connect with other caregivers and people who understand your journey. You know, it's not just about getting a good night's sleep. Sleep ain't rest. Rest is learning to recognize that it's not all up to you. And that's one of the landmines in my book, Seven Caregiver Landmines, thinking that it's all up to you, but it's not. We're here, and we're going to do this together. Go to standingwithhope.com for more. This is Peter Rosenberg. I'll see you next week.
I'm Gracie Rosenberger, and 26 years ago, I walked for the first time on two prosthetic legs. I saw firsthand how important quality prosthetic limbs are to an amputee. This understanding compelled me to establish Standing with Hope. For more than a dozen years, we've been working with the government of Ghana in West Africa, equipping and training local workers to build and maintain quality prosthetic limbs for their own people. On a regular basis, we purchase and ship equipment and supplies, and with the help of inmates in a Tennessee prison, we also recycle parts from donated limbs. All of this is to point others to Christ, the source of my hope and strength. Please visit standingwithhope.com to learn more and participate in lifting others up. That's standingwithhope.com. I'm Gracie, and I'm Standing with Hope.